Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this this expectation of precision, like it's engineering or something.
Right, yeah, like fixing a car.
Exactly. You break your arm, the
Yeah.
x-ray shows that jagged white line, and the doctor just points and says, "There it is, broken or not broken.
Yeah.
It's clean, it's binary." And I think it's comforting because we like things to be visible.
We want it to be easily categorized, yeah. But the brain doesn't really work like that.
No, it doesn't. You step into the world of psychiatry, into understanding profound states like psychosis and depression, and well, that x-ray machine is entirely useless. We're looking at a diagnostic landscape that is just murky.
Oh, it is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters. When you can't just image the brain to see a thought disorder, you have to find back doors to figure out the neurobiology.
And today, we're taking one of those back doors for this deep dive. We're drawing our insights from a really comprehensive article from the OOTW Journal. It's titled PCP Phencyclidine, the Neuroscience.
It's a fantastic piece of literature.
It really is. And our mission today is to explore this profound medical paradox. Basically, how a notoriously dangerous street drug,
Yeah.
and honestly, a totally failed surgical anesthetic, actually became the single most important chemical tool psychiatry has for understanding psychosis and treating depression.
Which is wild when you think about it.
Totally wild. So for you listening, we're going to strip away the folklore and the urban legends surrounding this terrifying drug and uncover how its spectacular failure in the operating room essentially revolutionized modern brain science.
Yeah, and to truly grasp the magnitude of that legacy, we really have to start at the drug's origin. So going back to 1956.
Yep, the 1950s.
Right. Chemists at Parke Davis synthesized phencyclidine, or PCP, and they initially introduced it as an intravenous surgical anesthetic called Cernal. And at first glance, I mean, it looked like a monumental breakthrough.
Which makes sense when you look at what anesthetics were like at the time, right?
Yeah.
Because the biggest risk with general anesthesia is that, sure, it puts you under and stops the pain, but it fundamentally depresses your central nervous system.
Exactly. Your breathing and your cardiovascular system can dangerously slow down or even stop.
Right. But Cernal provided profound analgesia, like a total disconnect from pain, while completely sparing the patient's breathing and circulation.
And for a surgeon, that profile is just the holy grail. You have a patient in this trance-like detachment, fully immune to surgical pain, but breathing perfectly on their own.
Sounds perfect. So what went wrong?
Well, the fatal flaw only revealed itself when the surgeries were over. When the drug began to wear off, up to 20% of patients, so that's 1 in 5, experienced what anesthesiologists termed emergence delirium.
Wow, 1 in 5. It's essentially like hiring a heavily armed security guard to watch your house.
Okay, yeah.
Like, sure, you absolutely won't get robbed while you're gone, but when you come home, the guard is barricaded in your living room, having a massive panic attack and shooting at the walls. The cure was almost worse than the surgery.
That is a perfect way to describe it. The operating room was totally safe, but the recovery room was just sheer chaos.
What were the patients actually doing?
They were waking up highly agitated, experiencing really vivid hallucinations, and remaining completely unreachable, sometimes for hours. They were profoundly detached from reality.
That sounds terrifying.
It was because of this unpredictable delirium, Cernal was completely abandoned for human medical use by the 1960s.
But Parke Davis didn't just throw at the chemistry,
Yeah.
right? They knew they had a molecular structure that achieved that safe, respiratory-sparing anesthesia.
Exactly. So their chemists went back to the lab, tweaked the molecule, and in 1962, they created a shorter-acting, safer analog, ketamine.
Ah, ketamine.
Yep, ketamine kept the safe breathing profile, but it shed most of those severe emergence problems.
So ketamine basically saved their anesthetic franchise.
It did, and it became one of the most widely used drugs in the world. Meanwhile, PCP leaked out of the lab and hit the streets as angel dust.
Right.
But here's the thing. The specific mechanism that made PCP fail so spectacularly in humans, that was about to crack open a massive mystery in neuroscience.
Because scientists needed to know what this chemical was actually doing to the human brain to cause that specific type of delirium, right?
Exactly. And that mystery wasn't actually solved until 1983. A group of researchers, Anais, Berry, Burton, and Lodge, discovered that both PCP and ketamine belong to a class of drugs called NMDA receptor antagonists.
Okay, let's break that down. Since the NMDA receptor is essentially the main microscopic gateway in our brain cells that opens up to let excitatory electrical signals pass through, an antagonist must be something that, like, jams that gate shut.
Yes, but the mechanics of how it jams the gate are just wild. PCP is not just a standard antagonist. It is an open channel blocker.
Meaning what?
Meaning it doesn't just sit on the outside of the receptor holding the door shut. The binding site for PCP, which is literally named the PCP site in the literature, is located deep inside the ion channel pore itself.
Wait, here's where it gets really interesting. So it's like a turnstile at a busy subway station, but you can only jam a stick into the gears to break it if the turnstile is actively spinning. You can't block it when it's closed.
That is exactly it. In neuropharmacology, that is known as use-dependent blockade. The drug can only physically reach its binding site and plug the pore when the NMDA channel is already actively open.
So the blockade literally tracks neural activity. The busier that specific brain receptor is, the faster it gets blocked by the drug.
Right. And the sources mention a potency ladder for this class of drugs, ranking them by how strongly they bind to that inner channel site.
Yeah, I saw that. You have a research chemical called MK801 as the strongest, followed by PCP. And then ketamine is actually the weakest of the three.
Exactly. PCP is far more potent than ketamine, and it lingers in that channel for much longer, which explains why a ketamine high might clear in an hour or two, but a PCP trip can drag on for what feels like an eternity.
Wow. And while that NMDA blockade is the main event, PCP has, like, supporting actors altering the brain's chemistry simultaneously too, right?
Oh, yeah. It inhibits the dopamine transporter, leaving more dopamine active in the synaptic cleft. It also acts on sigma receptors to modulate further dopamine release, and it blocks nicotinic acetylcholine receptors.
So hitting all those different circuits simultaneously gives it that stimulant, euphoric, and deeply hallucinogenic character.
Exactly. But because it jams this specific NMDA turnstile in such a profound, long-lasting way, researchers started to notice something strange.
What was that?
Well, the patients waking up from PCP in those early surgical trials didn't just look high. They looked like they were suffering from a very specific severe psychiatric disorder.
Right. The resemblance to clinical psychosis was so striking. And the article mentions that in 1959, a researcher named Luby published the first human study on PCP. He literally titled it a study of a new schizophrenomedic drug.
Right, a drug that perfectly mimics schizophrenia.
But wait, does this mean the old dopamine theory was just completely wrong? Because amphetamines can also cause psychosis, right? Mm-hmm. People who stay up for days on speed can get intensely paranoid and have severe hallucinations.
Yeah, and that historically fueled the old dopamine hypothesis, the idea that schizophrenia is simply caused by way too much dopamine in the brain.
So did the PCP discovery just add a missing puzzle piece that dopamine couldn't explain?
Pretty much. Amphetamine psychosis only goes halfway. It mimics what we call the positive symptoms of schizophrenia, the things that are artificially added to a person's reality, like paranoia, delusions, and hallucinations.
Okay, but it fails to reproduce the rest of the illness.
Right. Schizophrenia also carries devastating negative symptoms like severe emotional withdrawal, blunted affect, a total lack of motivation. And it has cognitive symptoms like formal thought disorder, disjointed logic, and severe memory deficits.
And dopamine overloads couldn't explain those.
No, they couldn't. But PCP uniquely reproduced the entire illness, positive, negative, and cognitive symptoms all at once.
That's incredible. The OTW Journal article notes that even decades later, in 1994, when researchers gave subanesthetic doses of ketamine to healthy volunteers, it produced this same broad schizophrenia-like picture.
Yeah, no other drug model came close to that level of replication, which birthed a massive paradigm shift in psychiatry. It created the NMDA receptor hypofunction hypothesis.
So the logic was, if artificially turning down NMDA signaling with a drug manufactures the full complex syndrome of schizophrenia in a completely healthy brain,
then naturally occurring low NMDA function might be the root neurobiological cause of the illness itself. It gave neuroscience a way to explain the cognitive and negative symptoms that targeting dopamine alone never fixed.
So studying the world's worst anesthetic gave us a literal blueprint for one of humanity's most complex mental illnesses.
Yeah.
But there's a glaring paradox here that I want to ask about.
Okay, let's hear it.
If NMDA receptors are excitatory, meaning they activate brain cells and push signals forward, blocking them should just put the brain to sleep, right?
Right.
How does blocking an excitatory receptor cause the brain to become radically hyperactive and hallucinate?
That is the big question.
Yeah.
And the answer to that paradox is one of the most elegant discoveries in modern circuit neuroscience. It has to do with exactly where these specific receptors are located. The NMDA receptors that are most highly sensitive to being blocked by PCP don't sit on the main excitatory neurons of the brain. They actually sit on a specific type of inhibitory cell.
Right. The fast-spiking parvalbumin-expressing GABA interneurons.
Exactly. So in any brain circuit, you have excitatory cells that push signals forward the gas pedal, which are the pyramidal neurons.
And you have inhibitory cells that use a chemical called GABA to keep things disciplined and stop the circuit from overloading.
Right. Those are the brakes.
So what does this all mean? If I'm hearing you right, it's literally like cutting the brake lines on a car. The engine, the pyramidal neurons, isn't necessarily revving harder on its own, but without the GABA brakes, the car just speeds out of control and crashes into everything.
That is a brilliant analogy. That mechanism is known as the cortical disinhibition model. You silence the inhibitory interneurons, the brakes come off, and the excitatory pyramidal neurons suddenly fire completely unchecked. This produces a paradoxical massive surge of glutamate in the brain. So by blocking one specific type of excitation, you basically unleash a flood of chaotic excitation everywhere else.
And this unchecked firing completely disrupts what are called gamma band oscillations, right?
Yes. These are the synchronized electrical rhythms your brain desperately needs for coherent perception, focus, and working memory. When those rhythms break down under that glutamate surge, your reality just fragments.
Which explains the hallucinations and the dissociation.
Exactly. Over time, animal models show that repeated PCP administration actually lowers GABA markers and physically damages prefrontal cortex function.
So the drug doesn't just mimic the symptoms of schizophrenia. Chronic exposure mimics the progressive cortical damage seen in the disease too.
Sadly, yes. Because this drug completely cuts the brain's internal brake lines, the behaviors we see out of the lab and in the emergency room are just as chaotic as the neurochemistry.
Which brings us to the reality of angel dust on the street. The pharmacokinetics, basically how the drug moves through the body, explain a lot of its terrifying reputation.
Oh, absolutely. The timeline of the intoxication heavily depends on the route of administration.
Like smoking versus swallowing it.
Right. If it's smoked, usually applied to a leafy material like mint, parsley, or marijuana, it hits the brain rapidly, usually in 2 to 5 minutes. If swallowed, the onset delays to about 30 to 60 minutes.
And how long does the high actually last?
The primary high usually lasts somewhere between 4 to 8 hours, but the elimination half-life is massively prolonged and highly variable, hovering around 21 hours.
21 hours, and that is largely because PCP is highly lipophilic. Right. It easily dissolves into and stores itself in fat tissue and brain tissue.
Exactly. So it leaches back into the bloodstream incredibly slowly. And that lipophilicity causes a terrifying phenomenon known as reintoxication.
Or they get high again without taking more.
Yes. A person might survive the initial acute high, feel entirely sober, and then days later, stored PCP re-enters their circulation. They suddenly start experiencing the severe dissociation hallucinations all over again.
That is wild. The clinical signs of someone presenting in the ER are also highly distinct from what the article says. At low to moderate doses, you see profound detachment, numbness, and slurred speech.
Yeah, and physically, there's a signature presentation. You see a totally blank, unblinking stare, catatonic posturing where they freeze in odd, rigid positions, and nystagmus.
A nystagmus, that's that rapid, involuntary darting or rolling of the eyes, right?
Correct. And alongside those physical signs, users frequently report a striking, delusional sense of immense physical strength and total invulnerability.
Which perfectly feeds into the urban legends. I mean, we've all heard the pop culture stories of the superhuman rampages, people breaking handcuffs or taking multiple tasers without flinching.
Oh, definitely.
But the source material specifically highlights a 1981 study by Dr. McCarron and colleagues that breaks this mythology down with hard data.
It really does. And it remains the gold standard because it analyzed a massive sample size, 1,000 consecutive cases of acute PCP intoxication in an emergency setting.
Wow, 1,000 cases.
Yeah. And the data is sobering precisely because it strips away the sensationalism. The idea of the guaranteed superhuman rampage is mostly a myth.
Right. Because violence did occur, but only in about 35% of the cases, which is clinically significant and incredibly dangerous for healthcare workers, for sure. But it also means 65% of people were not violent at all.
Exactly. In fact, 46% of the patients in that study were alert and oriented. Many presented as completely calm, or on the opposite end of the spectrum, they were catatonic, stuporous, or even comatose.
So if it's not a guaranteed zombie-like rage virus, the real life-threatening dangers are largely secondary to the intoxication itself.
Yes, trauma is a massive factor. Because the analgesia is so profound and they genuinely believe they are invulnerable, users do catastrophic physical damage to their own bodies without even realizing it.
Because they can't feel the pain.
Right. Then there is severe hyperthermia where the body temperature spikes dangerously high. But the most insidious and deadly risk is rhabdomyolysis.
Wait, I wanted to ask about this. If someone is completely agitated, out of their mind, and a danger to themselves, the instinct for a bystander or an orderly would be to physically hold them down or strap them to a bed.
Oh, absolutely. That's the natural instinct.
But the medical protocols emphasize that physical restraint is the exact wrong move here.
Yeah.
Why is physical restraint such a bad idea?
It all comes back to rhabdomyolysis. Mm-hmm. This is the rapid, massive breakdown of skeletal muscle tissue. When muscles disintegrate, they release a protein called myoglobin into the bloodstream in huge quantities.
And the kidneys try to filter this out.
They try, but the myoglobin is too large and toxic. It actually destroys the renal tubules, leading to acute, often fatal kidney failure.
Oh, wow. And fighting against physical restraints exponentially accelerates that muscle breakdown.
Exactly. If you strap down a patient experiencing PCP-induced agitation, they will strain against those restraints with maximum uninhibited force. Because they feel no pain and no fatigue, they will literally tear their own muscles apart fighting the straps.
That is horrific. And that extreme exertion also drives up their body heat, severely worsening the hyperthermia.
Yes. So modern emergency management completely pivots away from that. The protocol requires a calm, extremely low stimulation room and chemical sedation using benzodiazepines to relax the brain and the muscles.
So you have to pharmacologically de-escalate the nervous system. You cannot physically fight it.
You cannot. There's also a long-term risk caveat mentioned in the research regarding chronic use, known as Olney's lesions.
Right. In 1989, researcher John Olney found that high doses of NMDA antagonists produced physical damage in the brains of rats, specifically forming reversible vacuoles, or tiny fluid-filled holes, in certain cortical neurons.
Yeah, and the direct relevance of Olney's lesions to typical human exposures have been heavily debated, but it absolutely shaped decades of safety regulations and institutional hesitancy around this entire class of drugs.
But what is definitively clear in human populations is that chronic PCP use causes persistent cognitive deficits, impaired memory, heightened anxiety, severe speech issues that essentially mirror that permanent NMDA hypofunction model of schizophrenia.
Exactly. It's devastating.
Holding all these truths together is quite the balancing act. On the street, it's a deeply hazardous, unpredictable drug with zero therapeutic value. It's strictly regulated as a Schedule II controlled substance.
Right.
But in the laboratory, it was the perfect master key for reverse engineering brain dysfunction. And that brings us to its final, most redemptive legacy in modern medicine.
Yes, the intellectual value of PCP cannot be overstated here. By proving that the NMDA receptor was a druggable lever that could manufacture psychosis, it prompted researchers to ask a completely revolutionary question.
Which was?
If manipulating this receptor can cause such profound alterations in reality and mood, could tweaking it in a slightly different way actually treat severe mental illness?
This is where researchers made the leap from schizophrenia to depression. And the logic bridges across that glutamate surge we discussed earlier, right?
It does.
If a depressed brain is essentially stuck in a rigid, underconnected state with withered synapses, and blocking the NMDA receptor causes a massive temporary flood of excitatory glutamate, could that flood act as a sort of fertilizer for a depressed brain?
That was exactly the hypothesis that changed the world. Researchers theorized that a controlled, temporary glutamate burst could jog the brain out of its depressed rut and trigger rapid neuroplasticity, literally forcing the brain to grow new synaptic connections.
But they obviously couldn't use PCP to test this. The side effects and duration were just too catastrophic.
No, definitely not. So they turned to ketamine, PCP's safer, shorter-acting chemical cousin. And the results were completely unprecedented.
Because researchers discovered that a single sub-anesthetic dose of ketamine could lift severe, treatment-resistant depression and rapidly eliminate suicidal ideation within a matter of hours.
Hours, not the weeks or months required by traditional SSRI antidepressants. It entirely validated the glutamate hypothesis of depression.
So, a drug that literally manufactures temporary psychosis gave us the exact blueprint to cure treatment-resistant depression. It's like studying a computer virus to invent the ultimate antivirus software.
That is perfectly said. A drug class once exclusively associated with producing psychosis gave us the first truly novel mechanism for treating depression in half a century.
Wow.
This direct lineage ultimately led to the 2019 FDA approval of esketamine, marketed as Spravato, specifically for treatment-resistant depression.
So the entire modern frontier of rapid-acting antidepressants, where pharmaceutical companies are trying to target these exact circuits to keep the rapid mood benefits while shedding the hallucinogenic side effects, is completely downstream of those disastrous 1950s Cernal trials.
It really is. As the article states so perfectly, PCP found the door, ketamine walked through it.
It proves that in the scientific method, data is never truly wasted. Cernal was an objective, dangerous failure as an anesthetic.
Oh, totally.
But because researchers were willing to look at the exact mechanics of why it failed, rather than just throwing the molecule in the trash, they uncovered the underlying neurobiology of human consciousness and mood.
It's an incredible story of scientific persistence.
It really is. So for you listening, keep that in mind. The next time you hear about a clinical trial failing or a medical dead end, remember the story of fencyclidine.
Absolutely.
The absolute worst anesthetic in surgical history became the Rosetta Stone for modern psychiatry. It's a testament to the messy, nonlinear, absolutely brilliant nature of scientific discovery. Which leaves one final thought for you to chew on long after you hit pause. If chemically mimicking a devastating disease with a toxic street drug gave us the ultimate blueprint to treat depression, what other failed chemicals are sitting locked in a freezer in a lab right now, secretly holding the key to unlocking the mysteries of Alzheimer's or autism or even human consciousness itself? Maybe we just haven't figured out which X-ray machine to put them in yet.